Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Psychology of Work, Why People Do What They Do, a podcast exploring the science and stories behind high-cohesion, high-performing teams. My name is Dr. Bobbi Wegner. I'm a lecturer at Harvard in organizational psychology and the founder of Groups. In each episode, we dive into the minds of industry experts to uncover what drives team and individual dynamics, tackle real-world challenges together, and share actionable insights to help teams feel and function their best. Thanks so much for joining, and let's get started. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited to be here today on The Psychology of Work. I'm joined by Jonathan Gluck. He's a writer, editor, and author of An Exercise in Uncertainty, A Memoir of Illness and Hope. Jonathan has spent years shaping stories at New York Magazine and Vogue, and his writing has appeared in New York Times, Washington Post, and beyond. And his memoir really explores what it means to truly live when life is uncertain. So for me, I function more like an organizational psychologist, but I'm a health psychologist by training. So this conversation, I'm just particularly excited about. So Jonathan was diagnosed with incurable cancer at the age of 38 and has spent more than 20 years really navigating this in-between space between hope and realism, control and surrender, and really finding meaning in it all. As someone who studies team and leadership, I find his perspective profoundly relevant because uncertainty isn't just personal. It's something that every team, every leader, every organization faces. Jonathan, thank you so much for being here. Before we dive in, anything you'd like to add to your story or, you know, what comes to mind when you hear me sort of share all this about you?
Yeah, thanks for having me, first and foremost. Really appreciate it. And yeah, I think you captured it. That's been my journey. You know, I'm a journalist by trade, by day, and an author by night, and wrote this memoir, An Exercise in Uncertainty, to tell the story of my 20 plus years living with what I was initially told might be a cancer that I would only live with for 18 months. So it's been quite a remarkable journey.
I mean, I can't even imagine that. It's sort of like everyone's sort of worst nightmare happened and now you're sort of living in it. So what is your story? Can you kind of walk us back? Like, when did you get diagnosed? What did that look like? What were you even thinking, feeling at the time?
Yeah. So the story starts in 2002. I was leaving my office one night and I slipped on the ice, and it wasn't even a bad slip. I didn't fall. I didn't, you know, crash down. I just kind of twisted my hip. And in the morning I woke up and it hurt quite a bit. And I thought to myself, well, that's unusual. I didn't think I twisted it that badly. Maybe I'm just getting older, aches and pains, you know, everything starts to fall apart a little bit. But I gave it a few weeks, didn't really get better, went and saw my doctor. He took an x-ray and didn't see anything and sent me home with a physical therapy prescription. That was how I just went on for a while until the following November, one year after the initial incident happened, at which point a lot had happened in my life. I started a new job at New York Magazine, which was sort of a dream job for me. It was a place I had always wanted to work. My wife and I had our first child, my daughter AJ, in April of 2003. So by November of 2003, she was just 7 months old. We had moved into a new apartment. My life was going well by any conventional measure. And then November of 2003 came around. I realized, you know, it's been a year since I first twisted my hip. And not only is it not better, but it's worse. You know, I'm having trouble getting in and out of cabs. I'm having trouble getting up and down stairs, having trouble picking up my daughter. And I thought, well, I should go back to the doctor. So I went back to the doctor. This time he took an MRI, and I got a call from his office a few days later. Dr. Wiener would like you to come in to talk about your test results. And I was so incredibly naive. I thought, you know, gosh, what a nice guy. You know, in this day and age, a doctor wants to personally tell me about my test results instead of telling me over the phone or by email. But when I got there for the appointment, I instantly sensed something was up. The receptionist had a very kind of grave air about her when I said who I was. She kind of looked over her shoulder immediately. They were obviously waiting for me. The physician's assistant took me straight to the examination room. The doctor came in right away, sat down and said, I need to tell you, you have a lesion on your hip. And I said, I didn't even know what the term meant. I said, yeah. A lesion, does that mean a tumor? And he said, yes. And I said, does that mean I have cancer? And he said, yes. And like a lightning bolt out of the blue, that's how I found out.
Yeah. What even went through your mind? What do you do? I feel like you just go unconscious. Like, what happens?
Yeah. I mean, as a psychologist, I'm sure this answer won't surprise you, but it was just pure denial was my like gut first reaction. I literally said, no, 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 this can't be happening. You know, I have a 7-month-old daughter. I feel fine otherwise. This is impossible. It's not true. Mm-hmm. And then I started sort of, I went through the five stages of grief quickly. Mm-hmm. And then I started bargaining, you know. Well, there was more denial first. I said, is it possible this is just a mistake or a false positive, or that it's just, you know, something else? I started making up terms I didn't even really know the meaning of. You know, is it bone spurs or calcification? My mind was just grasping for anything that could explain this that wasn't cancer. That didn't work. And then I started bargaining pretty quickly in my own mind, like, please just let me see my daughter graduate from high school, which I have eventually done. And in fact, she graduated from college this year.
So
bonus points.
Yeah.
It was practically, the first reaction was just sheer denial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I was just thinking, we were chatting at the beginning, but it is around the same time. So I lost my dad, like, when I was 21. I graduated college in 01, and I ended up doing my senior project really on the stages of death and dying. And what I think in retrospect, what he was experiencing, kind of not knowing what he was, you know, I think he had a sense. He sat me down at one point, it was my fall of senior year, just said, Bobby, I don't think it's going to make it. I'm going to make it to the spring. I didn't know he was dying. I didn't even know he was that sick. And it was like the biggest sucker punch, you know, and just trying to figure out what that means. And he ended up passing away in January. And then I graduated in the spring and really ended up writing my paper on those stages of, you know, that I think he was going through. And then I kind of wrote a separate story of like my experience of what that was like in those stages. So those stages are real, right? Like the denial, the bargaining, and the, you're kind of forced to deal with this eventually, but there's like a psychological mind game I think we all play when awful news comes our way.
Yeah. And you also, you seek normalcy, I find, as much as you can or as quickly as you can. The first person I called was actually my boss, who I didn't even really know that well. I hadn't been working for her for that long, but I just called her and I didn't tell her why, but I felt compelled to call and say wasn't going to be coming in that day. I called in sick, basically. And I think that impulse looking back was just a way to try and act like it wasn't that big a deal, you know, as if I was calling in because I had a cold or the flu or something. Mm-hmm. It was also, I think, helpful to call somebody and do something where I didn't feel it was so personal or so intense. I had to work my way up little by little to telling, you know, my wife and my family. And that call was just a way, like I say, to almost another form of denial, just to pretend it was as if, you know, it was no big deal.
Yeah, I imagine it was like, if you can sort of like minimize it there, you can still play the part of like the healthy person. You know,
right.
And then if you say it out loud, it becomes real, right? And then,
That's exactly what you do with it.
So what happened then? So that was how many years ago?
22 years ago, roughly.
Yeah, 22 years ago. So like, I guess the whole podcast is on the psychology of human, psychology of work. Like, where are you today when you think about this? How did you think about writing this book? What prompted it? And then what's changed from the way you sort of think and see and feel today? And you know, those first days that you just described.
Yeah. So I decided to write the book. I'm about 3.5 years into my diagnosis. Basically, what's happened to me is what I have is a blood cancer called multiple myeloma, and it's incurable. Luckily, it's proven to be treatable so far in my case. That's by no means true in every case. I've been extremely fortunate. And one of the most profound things that's happened to me, I think, is I have like an incredibly deep sense of gratitude for even being here, which goes a long way in life, or so I've found. But I have been fortunate enough to, you know, have been diagnosed with what I have at a time when there have been an incredible number of new treatments that have come along, even since the time I was diagnosed. So I was originally told I might have as little as 18 months to live.
God.
It's now been 22 years. And that is 100% because of advances in medical science. I didn't even realize this until I wrote the book and had to put together the timeline in a very detailed way. But some of these treatments that I've had have only been approved by the FDA for use in patients like me, maybe in a matter of months before I needed them. So the timing has really been uncanny. So going back to, you know, why I wrote the book, about 3.5 years into my diagnosis, the pattern is basically I go in and out of remission constantly. So I get sick, I get treated, I go in remission, sometimes a partial remission, sometimes complete, sometimes for a very brief period of time, sometimes for a number of years. That's what's happened to me in the whole time since, medically speaking. So about 3.5 years after my diagnosis, I was in remission and I was working at New York Magazine still. And I wrote an essay about my experience with my illness to that point. And it was quite well received and quite popular. And I was fortunate enough to get a call from some literary agents and some book publishers to see if I might be interested in writing a book. And I said, you know, I love the idea, but I've kind of said everything I have to say at this point. I've told my whole story. But that planted the seed in the back of my mind that maybe someday I would do that. Flash forward many years. And in 2020 or so, 21, I started thinking, wow, the 20-year anniversary of my diagnosis is coming up. And that sort of did two things. One, it made me realize I now did have a ton more material, more material than I wanted, you know, about my illness to talk about and to write about, and probably enough for a book. And two, it gave me an ending. Just from a storytelling point of view, one of the things I had been wrestling with is, you know, this is an ongoing story, and most stories have an ending, either pass away or I'm cured. But because I'm in this strange middle ground, I didn't have an obvious ending. And the 20th anniversary, even though it's a little bit arbitrary, gave me a place to stop the book and say, this is where I'm at this point in time, that felt natural and like a organic ending. So that's what prompted me to go ahead and write about it. Practically speaking, in terms of the mission of writing about it or the purpose of writing about it, I really just wanted to share my story first and foremost with anyone who's gone through what either exactly I've gone through or something similar. And for that matter, and you touched on this, anyone who's been living with any kind of uncertainty. It's not just uncertainty doesn't just affect us medically or in terms of our health, obviously can affect us in a million ways. Our work life, our, you know, getting laid off, the wider world has never been more uncertain. Politics, conflict zones, you name it, you know, people face any number of large or small uncertainties at every moment of their lives. So I wanted to write about that as well and really try and share my experience with all of it for the simple reason, you know, there's that expression, literature teaches us we're not alone. I really wanted to make, you know, help do my part as somebody who's both a writer and a cancer patient. You know, there are lots of writers, lots of cancer patients, not that many people who are both. I wanted to take advantage of my position that way to share my story and hopefully help other people navigate their own.
Yeah, there's so much there. My mind's going in like 50 different directions. But I was just thinking too, around the time that you were first diagnosed, before I went to graduate school, I was actually working at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center doing clinical trials research for advanced melanoma patients, and then went back to grad school and got a doctorate in clinical psych and ended up specializing in health psych, and then writing my dissertation on how people use spirituality and religion with coping with traumatic brain injury, but really major illness. Like, how does this change? How do you think about yourself? How do you think about the world? How do you think about coping? How do you think about these larger existential factors? And then I was thinking, listening to you, you're a writer, you're an editor, you are a literary type person, and that we make sense of information through storytelling and articulating, can understand our own story better when we put words to it. You know, I could imagine at the 20-year anniversary, like, yeah, that makes sense. And then I'm just thinking, like, is the story really over? Or is this just like kind of actually a pause? There's a part of me, if I'm looking from like a narrative psychology kind of lens, you've chunked out the chapters of your story, or you're very much like living it still.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is exactly that. How do you live with this uncertainty for so long? And I did a bunch of research on the subject of uncertainty itself. And as you know, given what you do, you know, there's actually some really terrifically interesting research out there about it. And I spoke to one woman in particular who works at the University of California, and she has done some fascinating research. She's really made it her life's work to study this subject. And she's done some fascinating research around how people experience uncertainty and cope with uncertainty. So she told me about one experiment that really jumped out at me and has stuck with me, where they divided people into two groups and told them that one group was going to receive a small electrical shock and the other would not. But of course, they didn't know which was which. A huge number of the people just said they couldn't take it for more than a couple minutes. They were like, just give me the shock. In other words, they'd rather have the negative outcome than continue to wait. That's how bad we are at waiting and how uncomfortable uncertainty makes us as humans. So I said to this woman, her name's Catherine Sweeney, I said, you're the expert on this, you know, what helps? What can we do to cope with uncertainty? And she said, well, you know, she gave me some practical advice. There are simple things like just common sense, distract yourself as best you can when you're in these situations and keep busy. And She said the best thing that they've learned is the most successful is if you can get yourself into what we call a flow state or the zone where you're doing something that's deeply engaging. Yeah. And that can be different things for different people. For some people, that's yoga or meditation or baking or knitting. For me, it's fly fishing. That happens to be my thing. But anything that requires your full focus and attention, because it very simply just pushes all the other, there's no more room in your mind for thinking about these scary or upsetting or anxiety-inducing scenarios. So that was all great. And I said, well, you're the expert. What do you do personally when you're facing this kind of uncertainty? And she said, well, to tell you the truth, I'm really bad at it. And I said, well, that's depressing. You know, if anybody should be good at it, I'd hope it'd be you. And she said, yeah, she said, I understand that. She said, but the thing I tell people that I do find helpful is just knowing that it is super difficult to cope with can be really helpful and reassuring to people because you realize, you know, I'm not the only one who feels this way and I'm not the only one struggling with it. And instead of then beating yourself up for, oh gosh, not only am I anxious, but I'm not good at coping with anxiety, which is definitely something I used to do. It helps just to know that nobody's that good at coping with anxiety and that, you know, it's a very common struggle. And I find a lot of comfort in that.
Mm-hmm. It's not like you're doing it wrong or something. This is a normative part of it. With like sort of trauma response, we think of a normal response to an abnormal event. And it helps like sort of provide a little bit of relief. Like, okay, I'm not like crazy or nuts here. This is just like hard and it's human. And I think what you're hitting on too and what you talk about in the book is this idea that we have a want and a need to feel in control of our lives, to have like agency, but it's really comes from a place of safety. So if we can predict, right, it's like we, at the end of the day, are wired for survival. So if we can't predict something, it threatens that. It quite literally, if you're facing a cancer diagnosis. And then the other thing is really the sense of belonging. Like we need each other. And it sounds like for you, connecting through your writing and your book and sharing the story and talking to all these people helps meet some of that need, which I wonder can help. I wonder as a question, like, does that help with, I don't know, making some meaning around this in a different way?
Yeah, it definitely does. And, you know, even on a more basic level, when you talk about connecting, you know, I've been also incredibly fortunate to have a wife and kids and family who care and have been there to support me and go to appointments with me and, you know, help care for me when I've been quite sick. And there are many, many studies that show that if you're lucky enough to have a support system like that, it can have a direct impact on your outcome. Mm-hmm. Having human connection and support is tremendously important, both for your mental and physical health. And that's, again, I say that's something I'm tremendously grateful for. So, and then in terms of the other kinds of connection you're talking about, writing the book has been mind-blowing for me that way, frankly. It's really touched a nerve, particularly with people who've been through not just a multiple myeloma diagnosis, but any cancer diagnosis or any serious illness. I've also heard from a lot of people who've just been through many other traumatic life events that aren't medically related, but also kind of threw a curveball into their lives. And the responses have been unbelievably meaningful. There's hardly a day that goes by where I don't get a letter or email or DM from somebody, usually a total stranger, telling me that they've read the book or heard a podcast I've done or seen an interview in a magazine or newspaper. And then they share their story. That's something I've noticed, you know, again, probably something you know very well through your work. Just the power of getting your story off your chest, especially if you tell somebody who you believe is going to understand and get you and hear you and see you, is very powerful, you know. And so I've been joking with my family. I now know half the multiple myeloma stories of everyone in America who's been diagnosed with this, and I love it. I feel a really deep connection with folks like that, and I feel like that's a tremendous service. And I've heard from many of them that, you know, they've gotten a ton out of just knowing, again, that they're not alone. And I've tried to be as candid as I can about the good, the bad, and the ugly, frankly, of my diagnosis and what it involves and what living with this illness has meant for my physical health, my mental health, my career, my finances. I've tried to be extremely candid about all that. And I've heard again from a number of readers that that's been valuable to them because we all feel like there's a right way to go through something like this. And I've done my best to say there is no right way. There's just a messy, difficult, you know, challenging way. And however you handle it and people around you handle it is fine. Mine's been a mess at times, hardly easy, hardly pleasant. But I think by sharing that and being honest about it, you know, I've been able to hopefully help some people, you know, navigate it themselves.
Yeah, it makes me think too. I wonder if that's some way that you're imposing some control over in like an inherently uncertain situation. If it's like with the just planning, like helping other people predict what could be ahead based on your story. You can't take away the cancer, but you can plan for whatever the financial impact is or the relational impact or the work impact, and then put some sense of like predictability or structure there. That's kind of like your gift, it sounds like.
Yeah, I hope so. And as I said, I've heard from quite a number of people who've read the book who seem to feel that way. So it's incredibly rewarding. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've done work I've enjoyed most of my life, and it's pretty fulfilling and I've found rewarding. But the book has taken that all to, you know, 10 levels higher, because this is obviously so deeply personal for me. And every one of those messages means a tremendous amount to me, and hopefully, you know, means a lot to those folks too.
Yeah, I'm thinking too, I wonder, it sounds like you're just having these intensely personal and like really meaningful conversations with people. Have you always been that way, or has this experience like opened up a part of you?
Yeah, it's a great question. This is like a free therapy session. Do I have to? You can bill me afterward. I really appreciate this.
Well, part of why I ask is I think because I like conversations like that too. And I think being a psychologist invites those kinds of conversations. So when I don't get them in sort of just normal everyday human stuff, I'm like, it's boring, or I don't, or I'm not into the person anymore. Kind of.
That's interesting. I would say a couple things about that. One is, I like to have those kinds of deep, meaningful conversations, always have, but generally it's been with a very small circle of people, you know, who I really trust, who I've known for a long time. I don't do that, or I didn't used to do that easily or with strangers. The book has absolutely changed that. And I think part of it, I was just thinking about this for a different reason. Part of it has to do with, for a long time, I didn't want to identify primarily or even largely as a cancer patient. I tried to keep my diagnosis compartmentalized, you know, in a box. And for a while that worked, you know, it worked for me practically speaking, because my illness at the outset was caught relatively early and I wasn't especially sick. The treatments weren't especially debilitating. But then as time went by, that wasn't the case. You know, I did get much sicker and the treatments were much more difficult and I got much more deeply involved in the world of cancer in every way, shape, and form. And then 2 summers ago, I had the most difficult and debilitating and challenging treatment I've had. I was in the hospital for 3 weeks and then some. I had to quarantine the way we all did during COVID again for a couple of years. Actually, my immune system was very badly compromised and I don't mean to suggest I was locked in my house. I just mean I had to be extremely careful. I barely traveled. I tried to avoid crowded indoor spaces almost exclusively and certainly wore a mask everywhere I went. In any case, point is, I had this huge treatment that was with very lasting and powerful side effects. And that really shifted something in me mentally and physically, where I couldn't pretend I wasn't a cancer patient anymore. And then I decided to write the book and I dived into the entire history of my illness and learned more about it than I ever had before, and did all this research on uncertainty. And I did a bunch of research on caregiving, because that's been a big part of my story, how it's affected my wife and my kids and my family. And I did a bunch of research on caregivers. Anyway, by the time I got done with all of that and thinking about it nonstop and writing the book for several years, I came out on the other side of that as definitely somebody who understands now and accepts now that I am a cancer patient, you know, and everything that means. I'm not able to compartmentalize it anymore. And once that shifted and the book went out and I started to see the impact it was having that we were talking about before, and the response that the book has gotten, especially from people who've been through something similar, it's really opened me up now to the power of sharing my story with anybody, strangers, and having these kinds of deeper, I guess you could say, heavier conversations all the time. And they're not upsetting. For a time, I didn't do it, frankly, because it was upsetting, you know, and it can be scary. You can't control what somebody's going to say once you open up that conversation. You might hear things you don't want to hear. That used to upset me. It used to scare me. I used to stay away from it. But since writing the book, that's sort of changed. And now I feel more comfortable and even maybe eager is too strong a word, but I definitely see the value in it and the reward, and that can be very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always think about communication as like the currency of connection, and you've literally written your own story. I was just working with a company yesterday, totally not in this realm, but it was basically directors of centers at Boston College High School, right? So they build their own programs out. And what I was saying to them is like, you guys need to get this, like your pen on paper and exactly describe what you're doing here, because you can own your narrative rather than feel like someone else is putting their narrative on you. And I'm just like drawing parallels in my mind. It seems like in some way you've done that for yourself too, that it sounds like you've really integrated this part of your identity into who you are. And through the process of putting words down on paper, you can sort of, you've redefined it in some way. Instead of being this like thing that you don't want to be, it's like now it's a powerful tool that it's like potentially your purpose or the way you're actually making huge impact in the world.
Yeah, I would say I haven't thought of it as crisply as all that. Again, it's you know, another therapy session. I appreciate it. But that's exactly right. You know, I feel like it has, the process of writing the book has helped me integrate my story into who I am more deeply and understand it more clearly. And then that's given me kind of the power to share it with others. And that seems to be having a positive impact.
Yeah. Well, I just appreciate it so much and appreciate your willingness to like share your story with me and with the people who are listening. How can we help you? Like where can people get your book, or like what's, you know, any parting messages that or anything I didn't ask you about that you wish I asked you about?
Yeah, I guess I'll answer the practical question first. How to get the book. You can get it anywhere that books are sold and anywhere that audiobooks are sold and anywhere that Kindles are sold. So Amazon is a great place. Some people prefer more independent, either bookstores, brick and mortar, or bookshop.org is a great place if you're not somebody who wants to buy from Amazon. But you can find it even if just Google my name, Jonathan Gluck, and the book title, An Exercise in Uncertainty, you will see plenty of places to buy it. I should point out that a portion of all proceeds from the book I'm donating to cancer research. So you won't just be helping me sell books. You'll be helping a wonderful cause. And that's the answer to that part of the question. As far as anything else I would want people to know, I don't know. I guess, I mean, one thing people ask me a lot is what I've learned from all this, I guess, or, you know, if there are any lessons I've taken away. And I always say, you know, I hesitate to give cancer credit for anything good, because a friend of mine once joked that I should treat cancer like a house guest who I don't want to stay too long. You know, don't be too friendly or it'll stick around. So I never want to give cancer credit for anything. But the truth is, I have learned some valuable lessons. And if there's something you want to do, do it now. You know, we're not guaranteed tomorrow, none of us, whether you're sick or well. You're stronger than you think you are. When I first was diagnosed with this, I didn't think I could survive another minute, let alone another day or another week or month. And now here it is 22 years since, and here I am, and I've lived a pretty rich and wonderful life, all the other medical issues notwithstanding. And maybe the biggest thing is, like, I remember the day I was diagnosed, I had this weird thought about like this very intense awareness that there's like a death force in human existence. And, you know, that's coming for us all one day or another, you know. But then I also remember having this thought that there's a life force. Somehow these were the weird terms that were in my mind. Mm-hmm. And that we have this very powerful survival instinct. And I think maybe the biggest thing I've learned overall is, like, yes, there is a death force out there, but there's also this life force. And if we can tap into it, those of us who are fortunate enough to have the chance to, it can be really just as powerful, if not more so, than its opposite. And there's reason to have hope and believe that something good can come out of something bad, even when you're sort of in the depths of the darkness of it. So that's been a very powerful lesson for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could have to ask you 50-100 more questions, but what a powerful one to end on. So I just appreciate you, Jonathan, for being here today. And for those of you listening, absolutely go read the book. It's something, uncertainty is something we all experience. And there's lots of good tips and ways to think about this. And then just a beautiful story, like, on top of it. So thank you so much for being here, Jonathan. And, you know, hope to meet you in real life at some point.
Thank you so much. That'd be wonderful. I'd love that.